world, but mine. Will it be a big bang or a whimper? How does death announce itself when it's our turn at last? Of all people, I should know. But I don't. Not today. Not like this. What about her health? Benton asks me again. And I can't abide what I believe he's done. Ernie detected trace amounts of copper in the dust bunny, the fletching, I reply. He says it permeates the samples I collected. I guess it could be from the copper arrow, Benton says, but his mind is going through something else, making another dangerous calculation that will probably turn out wrong. Staying there is what she expects us to do, as opposed to what we're actually doing, which is driving away and waiting for Marino to die? Bile is coming up the back of my throat. We have to ask ourselves what she calculates we'd do. Benton's hands are loosely curled around the phone in his lap, and every other second he's looking at what's landing in the display. To start with, she'd predict you'd say what you just did, he adds, and he's in a different character, the one who takes over when he conjures up the devil, when he invites evil to be part of the discussion. If it's true she has a blood disorder and it's not being treated, I say to him, then she could be in trouble. Even as I ask this, the same doubts nag at me. Why would Carrie want me to know that her health could be compromised? Why would she use her self-produced video recordings to reveal that she has a potentially life-threatening gene mutation that killed her mother and her grandmother? If Carrie was telling the truth, why would she want me to know she suffers from polycythemia vera? By telling me that, she's given me reason to suspect she's physically compromised beyond any injury I might have inflicted on her at the bottom of the sea in Fort Lauderdale last June. I explained to Benton that if Carrie hasn't been having regular blood draws, she may be suffering from headaches and exhaustion. She could have weakness, visual disturbances, and serious complications that could kill or incapacitate her, such as a stroke. And it seems impossible to consider that a monster like her might ultimately be defeated in such a mundane way. I've checked with area doctors, phlebotomists, and clinics to see if someone even remotely fitting Carrie's description has been getting blood removed, Benton says to my disappointment and surprise. And the answer seems to be no. But she's masterful at disguises and creative options. Then you've seen the videos. I confront him again about the depraved heart recordings, and he doesn't say a word. How long have you known about them and her blood disorder? I push harder. I know about her suffering from polycythemia vera, he says. Am I to assume you've had access to lab values that show an increased hematocrit and bone marrow packed with red cell precursors? He says nothing. The answer's no. So in other words, Benton, I don't see how you could have known, unless you witnessed the same thing I did on recordings she covertly made. He's seen them, but he's not going to say it. If she's been in this area for the better part of a year, as we suspect, then she has to have some means of removing a unit or pint of blood every month or two, I then say, because he's not going to discuss what he's orchestrated and misrepresented. Unless she's found a different way to take care of her problem. She could have, he says. And right now I know my husband, and I don't. I'm reminded I couldn't do what he does for a living. I've never been motivated to form alliances and détentes with miscreants, with monsters. I don't pretend to understand them. I don't want to be their friend, and tend to resist the temptation of believing I can think like them. I probably can't. Maybe I wouldn't if I could, or maybe I already can and refuse to face it, but the love of my life, the man I sleep with, is a very different story. How the hell has this happened? I talk very quietly, scarcely audibly, as I listen for a boom or bang or what might be a bomb going off. It's happened exactly according to plan, Benton says. And he channels people like Carrie, or at least he comes disturbingly close to it. In his own baffling way, he doesn't judge those he pursues, and he doesn't hate them either. They're nothing more than sharks or snakes or other deadly creatures in the grand pecking order and food chain of things. He accepts that their behavior is predetermined, as if they have no will of their own. He has no feelings about them. Not feelings the rest of us can begin to understand. She presents us with a choice and believes she knows exactly what we'll decide, he says, as I head to the office, finally at almost 5:30. At least at the CFC, I'm only minutes from the river basin, should the worst happen, and in typical fashion, I begin to envision what that scene would look like. Then I stop myself. I can't bear to imagine Marino dead, much less blown apart. He's always joked about knowing far too much about death and how humiliating it can be. He wouldn't want people laughing at his autopsy pictures. You'll make sure they don't pass them around and make fun of me, right, Doc? Because I've sure as hell seen them do it with other people. Who's at the Gilbert house? Anybody yet? I ask Benton as he scrolls through something on his phone. We've got agents on location. Ernie wonders if there's an area of the house we don't know about that might explain some of the evidence we're identifying. Your agents might want to look around the property for some area that isn't readily visible, I'm saying when his phone rings. Yes, he says. And then he listens. It has to be coming from somewhere, he finally replies, curtly, not particularly nicely. He gives the cross street address of where we are, and ends the call. He turns to me and says, we've got four agents there, and all of them heard the same thing, some weird slamming noise they can't identify. Marino and I both heard something similar a number of times. I continue checking my mirrors for the filthy smoke plume of a black powder bomb going off. I listen for an alert tone on the scanner that might indicate an emergency, but I see and hear nothing that might hint at what's happening with Marino. I keep telling myself he must be all right, or I'd know. He must have drilled a decent-sized hole by now and has the borescope's long camera probe fed through so he can see what's inside. You mind swinging by there? Benton asks. And I don't understand. Excuse me? The Gilbert house. Let's see what they're talking about. The noise has to be coming from somewhere. Chapter 47. I turn on Binney Street as more minutes pass. I've heard nothing about Marino and I can't stand it. What's going on with him? I ask Benton as we drive back toward the Harvard campus. It shouldn't take any time at all to know what's inside the trunk. To thread the camera head through, he'd need about 9 or 10 millimeters, a hole about that size, which isn't that big. He must know by now what's inside, I add. And it hasn't escaped my notice that I'm not hearing sirens. I've heard nothing on the scanner that might indicate Hyde has been found inside the trunk, and a rescue squad is responding. I've heard not a peep from Rusty and Harold. Lucy and Janet are safely out of their house, Benton says, as if that's what we were talking about. And he's skimming through messages on his phone, using some encrypted FBI app that allows him to communicate safely, privately. I suggested the best place to drop them off for now is your office. I didn't think they should be at our house yet, or anywhere else, until we have a better idea what's going on. What about Desi and Jet Ranger? All of them are safe, Kay. I have a text from Janet. She says Desi and Jet Ranger will wait in your office. When you get there, everybody will be waiting, and that's a big relief to hear. It's nice she texted you. She must know we're together right now. Somehow. Why do you say it like that? He asks as he stares straight ahead. She didn't text me. She must figure you'd tell me. Janet would know how worried I am, I reply. And Benton doesn't answer. It's easy for me to forget that the two of you were friends before she knew Lucy. In fact, you introduced them to each other. It was one of my better decisions. She signed up with the FBI because of you. And I'm very glad, because she might not have met Lucy, and I'm not sure where we'd be right now if it wasn't for Janet. And she's texting you, but not me. I make that point again. She hasn't asked you to pass along to me that they're okay, and that's surprising because she knows what I'm feeling. I was on their property this morning. She's aware of my concern, to put it mildly. We've always had a special closeness. Even during the years they were broken up and out of contact. Janet kept up with her through me, he says. She's always been Lucy's biggest protector, including now. Yes, he looks at me. It would be good if you'd leave it at that. I can't possibly. I couldn't help but notice that Janet seems very aware of the cameras inside their house, especially in the machine shop, where Lucy was removing tiles from the floor, pulling out rifles the FBI missed. I had a funny feeling Janet knew they were being filmed. Benton doesn't reply, and I hear Carrie's voice in my mind. I see her gleaming eyes as she talks into the camera. And you know the evolutionary purpose of psychopathy now, don't you? If I didn't know better, I'd think Janet was trying to hurt Lucy, not help her, I hear myself say to Benton as I remember the recordings I watched. Because I'm not sure how it helps Lucy's case if she's caught on video obstructing justice, committing a felony. A video that could be very destructive if it ever became public, Benton says. The Democrats in particular don't need to further inflame the NRA, for example, by showing two young women fearing for their lives and the life of their child because the FBI rolled in and took all of their guns for no good reason. We've never had a substantive conversation, not even a cordial one, and that's shocking. When one considers what you could learn from me. Carrie was talking to Benton. Long years ago, she made the recordings with him in mind, and I say that to him as we drive through the Harvard campus, past the yard with its old brick walls and wrought iron. As I think back to everything I watched in her depraved heart's secret recordings, it makes sense that she was never talking on camera with me in mind, I say to Benton. She was talking to you. A supreme narcissist like that, and she assumes I want to know the slightest detail about her. He confirms he's seen the recordings, but there's more to it than that. You did this. You and Janet. I'm accusing Benton, and at the same time, I'm strangely relieved. I've been lied to for the best of reasons. Benton's first loyalty is his family. The two of you are trying to save our family, and in doing so, may get all of us destroyed. I hope this is the truth. I'm not going to get us destroyed, Kay, he says. Neither is Janet. And you need to leave it at that. And what about Lucy's involvement? How much is she in on all of this, Benton? You need to leave it, Kay. He says, but I can't. You've created a record that you hope will clear Lucy's name while showing that Erin Loria is a compromised agent who is trying to entrap her. I glance over at him, and my misgivings grow. The recordings from 1997 are real, and they aren't. They're edited. You turned them into fiction to manipulate. I turned them into what they needed to be. We're in the next election cycle. The Budo story would be very unfortunate timing, he says, and it's all the more believable because Janet is on film saying things that are unhelpful and damaging for Lucy. That's what makes it authentic. Janet is saying things that could incriminate Lucy, but it won't matter by the time the Bureau has to deal with the rest of it. The timing is terrible. And Carrie knew it would be when she tampered with records relating to the Budo case. For the FBI. For the current administration, yes, the timing is bad, I reply, but not for Carrie. She wouldn't give a damn about what you just said, beyond her ecstasy that she's managed to orchestrate a disaster. So who put Janet up to filming what happened in their basement? I think back to when I was inside Chanel Gilbert's bedroom and realized Benton was standing in the doorway. I now have no doubt he was watching the same live-streaming video I was. He and Janet are partners. Lucy may be their partner, too. The three of them are in on this, and I'm the odd person out. Benton admits nothing, but it's making sense. What about the other videos, I then say? The ones Carrie is supposedly responsible for. I just need you to say that you're the reason for them. That you're the one who made sure they were sent to me. We have spousal privilege. Benton looks at me. We don't ever mention this conversation. But yes. And Janet has been helping. And the timing of my getting these little cyber bombs that I was supposed to worry were from Lucy's in case of emergency line? You must have planned this for quite a while, and I'm trying to figure out the connection between your sending these to me and Chanel Gilbert's ending up dead. Her murder is Carrie's timing, not ours, Benton says. But is there a connection? Yes. It would appear that she's known for a while who and what Chanel Gilbert was. When you consider Carrie's previous ties to Russia and what we know she was doing over there for at least the past decade, it's no surprise that she would have encountered some of our people from the intelligence community. Were Carrie and Chanel personally involved? It wouldn't surprise me. I assume you pulled the trigger on making sure the depraved heart videos were sent to me because you knew Lucy was getting raided this morning, I then say. And Benton doesn't answer me. I just need to know you had nothing to do with Chanel being killed. Jesus, Kay, of course not. He holds my stare and again says, you need to leave it. Suffice it to say that the information in those recordings you watched will derail what Erin Loria is trying to do to Lucy, and now is a good time to trust me. We shouldn't talk about this anymore. Stupid me not to figure it out. I turn the wipers off because the rain has almost stopped. The red flag should have been that Carrie confessed she has a blood disorder, that she might have a physical impairment. I don't have to be a profiler to intuit that she wouldn't want to come across as weak, not to me. But she couldn't resist making such a confession to you. Transference. It's not so different from what happens between a patient and a psychiatrist. I look at him. How long have you had these recordings? Benton? Pretty much since they were made. Lucy figured it out? Not at first. If you listen to them unedited, Carrie refers to me by name, not you. Then Lucy has seen them too. You, Janet, and Lucy are all in this together. I thought so. Okay. At least I know. A soupy grayness blurs lights and obliterates the tops of tall trees and buildings. Harvard Square is almost deserted and shrouded in fog. I think it's safe to say that all of us need to be in this together, Benton replies. The MP5K was a movie prop, and the firearms reports linking it to an assassination were probably faked, I then say. And the videos, as it turns out, are propaganda. They're not, Benton interrupts. The footage is genuine, and Carrie did hide cameras in Lucy's dorm room. You've had the recordings for 17 years and suddenly decided to edit them into clips that were sent to me. I follow the trail to where I'm sure it leads. You're using Carrie's own covert recordings against her, and that presupposes she's seen the depraved heart clips, too. It's safe to suppose that. Then that can only mean one thing. Carrie Grethen is into everything, I say to Benton. And the Gilbert driveway is up ahead. She's seeing everything we do. Now you're hitting the mother lode, he says. Data fiction. That's what this is about, he says. That's Carrie's big coup. Yes, she's seeing and manipulating pretty much everything, and has been for a while. We bump and splash over the same old pavers, through the same deep-standing water and puddles. I park behind three Bureau SUVs in the driveway, near the front of the house. Do you have contact with your people? I cut the engine. Because in light of everything else, let's not venture inside until we know your agents are alive and well and accounted for. I don't need to repeat what happened in South Florida 2 months ago. I don't need to find out the hard way that Carrie has killed our backups. I'm giving you a heads up that a couple of the same agents who are on Lucy's property are here because of the presumed connection between Lucy and Chanel, Benton says. And he goes on to explain that the four agents inside have spread out. Other than the peculiar thudding noise that sounds like a heavy door slamming, they found nothing unexpected. That's what Benton says Aaron Loria has reported to him, and we're on the porch now. He tries the front door. It's unlocked. The alarm system is disarmed. I hear a chirp as we open the door, but it's not the alarm system. It's Benton's phone. He looks at the display. He places his hand on my arm and shows me an image sent to him, a photograph the boroscope took of the inside of the trunk. There's nothing there but the usual police gear neatly stowed. I can make out a first aid kit, a roll of toilet paper, a stack of paper towels, spray bottles of all-purpose cleaner, Windex, jumper cables. Benton opens the door, and we step inside the foyer, and the odor of decomposition is fainter now, and we hear the thud again. It's muffled but loud. It's what we've heard before, and then it happens another 2 times in rapid succession. Boom, boom. A heavy slamming that sounds faintly metallic, and it seems louder than I remember it, as if the volume has been turned up. Benton and I look around. We don't hear or see a sign of anyone. He reaches under his suit jacket and slides out his gun, and we walk through the foyer. We stop every few steps and listen, and as we get closer to the door that leads down into the basement, I hear voices. Benton opens the door, and Aaron Loria sounds distressed. Chapter 48. The first sign of trouble is that the light over the stairs no longer works. I have a flashlight in my shoulder bag, and I dig for it in my 9mm as I hear Aaron Loria yelling somewhere below us inside the pitch-dark cellar.
FBI! Come out now with your hands up in the air!
I paint the light on the stairs, on the cave-like walls, and at the bottom I try more light switches, but they aren't working either. If there are other agents inside the house, there is no indication of it. I feel we are alone. I feel we have made what may prove to be the worst mistake of our lives.
FBI! Come out now with your hands up in the air!
Aaron Loria's voice is a recording. And then the sound again. The booming thud, and it seems to be coming from the rear of the basement, past the bulkhead doors toward the back of the house.
FBI! Come out now with your hands up in the air!
Carrie is mocking us with a recording of Aaron Loria reciting what sounds like a line from a campy cop movie. The FBI agents aren't down here, or if they are, there's no sign of it. And I realize, as I shine the light around the empty cellar, that we are where we're supposed to be. We're here as planned, but not our plan. It's her plan. Stay right behind me, Benton says under his breath. There is no other place for me to be. I can't run. I can't stand still in the dark while he walks around with his gun. Then the light touches an area of stone that is out of alignment with the wall around it, and this is deliberate too. I draw Benton's attention to what appears to be a secret opening, and we walk toward it as the thudding sounds again. A heavy slamming as we get closer. Benton pushes the wall with his foot, and it moves, and the thudding sounds again as we find ourselves staring into the dark mouth of a tunnel that is very old, possibly as old as the house. I smell the stale, cool air of a closed-up space, and I shine the light through the arched opening to the left of us. The boom sounds again, and the tunnel lights up as if a bomb has gone off. Troy Rosado's shrieks are drowned out by the sound, and it's not possible he could be heard anywhere else in the house. He's underground, chained by his wrists to iron rings in the wall. Another boom, and a flash of glaring light, and I see his crazed eyes, his short dyed blonde hair. He's naked except for a towel tied with rope around his narrow hips like a Tarzan loincloth. Dangling barely within reach is a malignant mobile comprised of a small green teddy bear, Mr. Pickle, and a Swiss Army knife, the one from Lucy's dorm room. There's also a silver key, a bottle of water, and a candy bar. They're connected by bare copper wires that have been rigged in such a way as to shock Troy if he grabs for a drink or food or a way to free himself. More bare wires dangle from the ceiling and touch his head, shoulders, and back like jellyfish tentacles, and I can smell his foulness as we get closer. In the background, a stainless steel industrial freezer has glass panels on the double doors, and I can make out the units of blood inside hanging from racks, scores of pint bags, dark red and frozen. She's been drawing her own blood. I notice a work area set up, tools, a food processor, empty glass bottles. Draped over an old wooden work table is a pair of black silk pajama bottoms. A naked dress form mannequin on a metal stand looks like a faceless torso, and I see the silvery glint of mirrors everywhere. Troy makes a grunting noise as he suddenly lunges at the mobile. His spastic fingers graze the Swiss Army knife, and it swings perilously as the thudding sounds, and he screams, and the light pops like a camera flash. Troy! I call out to him, and his eyes widen, and he looks around in deranged fear. I know why we've been lured here. Carrie expects us to save him. But she will exact a price that I'm already deciding I won't pay. He may be the only witness who can claim that Carrie is alive and responsible for what's happening, and I feel certain that's the choice I'm supposed to make. I need Troy for Lucy, and I can see Benton going into his mode like a fighter plane revving up for an airstrike. Troy? Over here. Turn around and look behind you. It's Benton talking to him now, and I touch his arm. Benton? Don't. The pressure in my grip communicates that he shouldn't get any closer. I see the bare wires and the water on the stone floor, and I tell Benton that we can't reach Troy without running the risk of being electrocuted. But Benton is in the same mode Marino was in moments ago. You do your job. You risk your life. You sacrifice if that's what it takes, because that's what people like us are sworn to do. Troy reaches a shackled hand up toward the silver key. He swats at it feebly, spastically, as if he's half awake during a terrible dream. Then he tries to grab the knife, and each time the mobile stirs, it completes an electrical circuit. There's a boom and a blinding flash, and Troy screams. As he jerks his head, I notice the gaping linear wound running down the back of it. A dark, gory crust where part of his scalp has been cut from the crown of his head to the nape of his neck. His narrow white chest rapidly moves in and out as he almost hyperventilates from panic. His gaunt face is patchy with stubble and a fuzzy mustache, and he cowers at the sound of approaching footsteps. But we don't see anyone. No one seems to be in here except the three of us. And I realize what we must be hearing is another recording that is being infernally piped in wherever Carrie decides. The footsteps sound again and seem to be closer, and Troy's reaction is Pavlovian. His reflex is to react with terror. No, please, no! He begins to make whimpering sounds like an infant, tiny cries interspersed with gasps as metal clanks and scrapes against stone.
No!
He begs as his legs go out from under him. He slips on the wet stone floor and struggles to regain his balance. He seems too exhausted to stand as the weight of his body threatens to pull his arms out of their sockets. He's collapsed like a rag doll, and then he's standing again, swaying and looking around blindly. He flaps at the key again and hits the bottle of water, and it knocks into Mr. Pickle, and the thudding slams and booms and the light flashes each time Troy is shocked.
Not again! Please!
He spits through the space where his front teeth used to be.
Please don't hurt me anymore! Please!
He cries convulsively and can barely speak.
Please!
He cowers, turning his naked back to us, and the long linear burns covering it and his shoulders are puffy and different shades of red. He grabs at the key hanging almost in reach of his shackled hands, and then another boom. He shrieks and collapses, bawling up on the wet floor like a threatened centipede.
No, no!
He screams.
Please, I'll be good. Please let me go. I'll do anything. No!
His screams rip the air as the thudding sounds again and again. And I remember what Lucy said to Janet a little while ago about the gates of hell. Don't let them slam me in the ass on my way in, Lucy repeated what she claims Carrie used to say to her. And that's the sound that comes to mind each time. The gates of hell slamming. A prison door banging shut. Troy sobs convulsively. And I understand what Carrie has set up. I'm aware of the choice I'm supposed to make, and that it's a damnation, a punishment tailored just for me, and I notice the dust balls on the floor. I notice the water everywhere, shining and glinting when my light skims over dirty stone. There's a bucket filled with a liquid near Troy's bare feet. I suspect he keeps kicking it over, possibly while trying to move it close, and I can see how dried and cracked his lips are. He's dehydrated and hungry, and Benton wants to save him. Benton, do not get any closer, I say, as Troy is shocked again, and I realize that every time we've heard the slamming sound, it's him being tortured. By now, he's so brainwashed and conditioned, he no longer seems able to discern between real and remembered pain. When the recording booms, he shrieks and cowers no matter what, and I smell ammonia. I smell the fresh stench of his bowels opening up as he soils himself and the floor beneath his filthy bare feet with their long, curled nails. As if this once beautiful boy is being turned into a beast like a goat. We have to get him out of here somehow, before he's electrocuted, Benton says to me as he looks around, and I know what he has in mind. He wants to find a junction box. He's looking for a circuit breaker. He's inches from the wet area of the floor, and I have no question what he intends to do. Benton is going to try to rescue this kid who assisted in murdering his own father. A kid who sets fires, bullies, and sexually assaults whomever he pleases. Troy Rosato is garbage, and I'm not allowed to have an opinion like that. He's done nothing in his life but hurt people, and I'm not supposed to feel that either. Keep still. Benton is going to save him. Do not get any closer, I warn. Troy has been made psychotic by fear and pain. And he weakly flaps a hand around, groping the air for the small silver key dangling from a long copper wire, groping for the knife, and Mr. Pickle dances slowly in the air. He looks exactly as I remember him, the same way he did in the first video I watched this morning. The memory of it is awful, and I'm frantic for a way to stop what's happening. You need to stay still, Benton says to Troy. You need to be still so we can get you out of here, son. But Troy has been deconstructed, and the person who may have existed before is gone. He can't comprehend what we're saying or doing, and he continues to flap his hands at the key, at the bottle of water, at the candy bar, at a silly toy bear I rescued from a junk shop in Richmond decades ago. The demonic mobile is alive around his head as he continues to shock himself and shriek, and my attention fixes on the bucket, and I bend over and pick it up. It's full of water, and I step in front of Benton, my feet barely an inch from the wet area of stone flooring. "What are you doing?" he exclaims. "I'll be damned if either of us is going to die. I'm sorry if Troy might," and I dash the water on him, on the wires dangling over him, and they spark and pop as they short out. Silence and darkness, and the recorded slamming sounds have stopped. I smell singed hair and flesh as I grab the silver key dangling over Troy's head. I unlock his shackles. I lower his limp body to the floor and begin CPR. 1 week later. Sights and sounds are triggers. Water splashing into the sink. The clicking of an induction burner turning on. The screen door banging. Glasses and silverware clinking. Bottles clanking. Backfires on the street. Mundane events are evocative of what's been uncommon and abnormal. "What are you having?" I ask Benton, as I obsess over tomorrow's front page of the Boston Globe. I don't want to get into a disagreement. I don't want to care, and I'm trying not to spend my energy on anger. Benton has told me all about that story and other ones, and he should know, since it was his Boston division that planted them. Waving the flag, taking the credit. FBI traps mass murderer in secret tunnel. Those are the sorts of headlines and sound bites we're hearing with more on the way. And it's all a lie. It's all utter bullshit. The FBI didn't trap Kerry Grethen. Troy Rosado isn't a mass killer. He didn't murder FBI agents or police. He's also not responsible for what happened in the cellar, not for any of it. He was nothing more than a victim. But the FBI can't resist spin doctoring. They might just have invented data fiction and are about to be done in by it. I don't know. Benton moves bottles around, checking labels. I'm torn. Maybe I shouldn't drink anything. Tomorrow's going to be a hell of a day after that damn story breaks. It includes photographs of the tunnel, which dates back to the late 1600s, when hundreds of acres were settled by a wealthy Englishman named Alexander Irons. Married with 8 children and many servants, he had much to protect. Extant original property records indicate he kept secret cellars full of food, gunpowder and weapons, and a fortune in silver, gold, and furs. There were rumors in his day that he might have been involved in privateering, a polite word for piracy. We know for a fact he had sub-basement cow stalls, which looked like an ice cube tray of windowless cells with stone sides and dirt floors. They're below the house, about halfway between Kerry Grethen's torture chamber and the hedge in back where I noticed loose bricks and stones. What I'd love is a martini, but I'm afraid that will do me in for the night. Steam clouds up as I empty a pot of boiling water and pasta into a strainer in the sink. Booze, booze everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Bottles clink as Benton looks through a cabinet of single malt whiskies and small batch bourbons. I don't know. What goes with prosciutto di Parma and mortadella? Everything. But there's a sparkling Malvasia if you'd like. I shake the strainer over the sink, draining all of the water out. That's good with the antipasto. Or there should be a Frigia di Asti. I pour the steaming tagliatelle into 2 big bowls. Something light and fresh would be nice. Not for me. More bottles clink. I think I need something strong. Nothing heavy, ponderous, and peaty. I tear up basil leaves, and their fresh, bright scent makes me happy until I remember why I shouldn't be. I'm in the mood for something easy. We've been chatting about cocktails for the past hour, going back and forth and around as I cook a comfort food dinner of ragu alla contadina and also a vegan version of it. It's as if we can't make decisions about the smallest things, but we talk about recent horrors easily. We decisively discuss running away and starting all over, and we explore incarceration, disability, and death in detail. But we can't decide between wine and whiskey. We don't know what we want. It's weird when you can't think of anything that might make you feel soothed. Benton has said this repeatedly over recent days, and it's more an observation than a complaint. Not that we don't feel stressed on a regular basis, but usually it doesn't last this long. It's not relentless. I have more empathy for people who feel like this all of the time. It's no wonder they medicate with cigarettes and booze. Medicating sounds good right about now. I dribble unfiltered cold-pressed olive oil over pasta, tossing it with wooden spoons. I'm not sure I remember feeling soothed. It's been so long. I blend in fresh grated Parmesan Reggiano, crushed red pepper, and the basil. I know how to soothe you. Promises, promises. A second bowl of pasta is for Lucy and Janet, and I leave out the cheese. As I said, it's been so long. Well, we can't have that. Don't get too sleepy tonight. Benton finds glasses in another cupboard. A red, maybe a Valpolicella would be civilized, I suppose. He goes to the wine cooler, opens the door, and shuts it without selecting anything. He returns to the liquor cabinet and illustrates exactly what my father meant about actions telling the truth, about people speaking with their feet. Benton sets two crystal tumblers next to a bottle of scotch. Glenmorangie, aged 18 years. He pulls out the cork with a quiet pop. No worries about my being sleepy. I stir crushed plum tomatoes into the sauce, and the kitchen is filled with the savory aroma of onions, garlic, and fresh herbs from earthenware pots on the sun porch. If anyone wants wine, I recommend the Rincione. You can go ahead and open a bottle. It should breathe before Jill gets here. She'll drink the hard stuff, I'm pretty sure, he says, and I hate the reminder. Let's put Frigia d'Asti on ice. Maybe we can pretend this will be a festive dinner full of pleasant conversations, as opposed to an interrogation we'll pay for by the hour. Try not to be negative about her. Oh, I'm not negative. Just realistically unhappy about spending an evening with her. She's trying to help. She would do anything for us, Kay. I consider her a friend. I understand that it's not her fault I dread seeing her. She can't help it that I don't want to hear her voice right now. I'm sure it's not her choice that she represents everything wrong in our lives. It's through no damn fault of her own that I associate her with everything I care about being taken and destroyed. Nothing has been taken and destroyed, Kay. Benton's voice is gentle, his eyes soft, and I can feel his love for me. We won't allow anything that matters to be taken from us. I don't want Desi to be frightened by what she says. We'll protect him, I promise. But he's been hearing it, Kay. He's actually taking things in stride. Maybe better than I am. I stir wine into the sauce. But I don't want him worrying that his Aunt Lucy could go to jail, or worse, that she's bad, that she used her Swiss Army knife to break into the back of my truck, and that her childhood teddy bear was involved in torture. Tool marks on the flathead screwdriver matched what was used to remove screws in the taillight. The red Swiss Army knife and Mr. Pickle are evidence that could be used against Lucy. I have no doubt this was part of Carrie's plan, and I don't expect to have a pleasant evening. Let's just get through this. Benton kisses me and pours our drinks. Jill Donahue is on her way here, and the visit isn't social. For the most part, it will be miserable, as we fill her in on what has occurred and what we should expect, which is nothing less than anarchy. There are possible criminal charges to explore, and of course I'm waiting for Troy Rosato to sue now that he's no longer in critical condition. The rest of them are dead, and I can't stop seeing their bodies piled in an old cow stall. I see them vividly when I least expect it. The images are there in my mind like a huge graphic painting, a gruesome mural that wraps around the walls. I see death and destruction and a future that offers little hope as we face the ugly fact that everything we've built in our careers has been compromised. Possibly it's been perverted and completely destroyed. Worst of all is the thought that every case we've worked will be overturned and evil people will be free to pick up where they left off. A little more ice, please. I set down my whiskey tumbler and make mine a double. She just pulled up. Benton is peeking out the window by the breakfast table. She's early. I turn off the stove. I take off my apron and absently run my fingers through my hair. There's no mirror in the kitchen, and it's just as well. I know I look like hell. The first part of this past week, I didn't leave the office. I didn't sleep. It wasn't just the caseload and associated complications, which are massive. I didn't dare vacate the premises or close my eyes while Amanda Gilbert was on the prowl and the feds were everywhere. The FBI has been frantic in its investigative and PR efforts to determine how it was possible that four of their agents, including Aaron Loria, were murdered without a struggle. They must have been lured downstairs the same way Benton and I were, and somehow Carrie electrocuted them, possibly by tricking them to step on the same wet flooring Benton was about to walk across when I short-circuited the electrical booby trap that I'm now certain would have killed him. I will always wonder what I was hearing. For the rest of my days, I know I'm going to wonder in anguish. The boom, the thuds happening in quick succession, and as I remember them, I'm haunted by the fear that what I was hearing was those four agents dying. I'll never know, but will always worry that Carrie was killing them, even as Benton and I were inside the Gilbert house. She dragged the bodies deep into the tunnel, piling them into the same stall where we eventually would find Hyde. At least he died more humanely than the others, stabbed in the back of the neck with a copper arrow that was then planted inside my truck. It's unlikely he knew what hit him. He didn't suffer. His spinal cord was transected. He was blessed with instant death. Maybe we could have a little music? I take the tumbler of scotch from Benton after he's dropped a few more ice cubes in it. It might not soothe us, but it will help. The liquor heats up my nose and the back of my throat. Maybe the magic flute. So in good operatic fashion, we can be reminded of the ordeals that lead to enlightenment. Benton heads to the sound system in the hallway closet. Before we're cast into the eternal night. Momentarily, the overture begins. I chop celery to the crashing of big brass, answered by argumentative piccolos and scurrying strings. The FBI and CFC databases have been hacked. Benton carries a platter of cured meats and bread to the teak table in the backyard, where all of us sit. There's no telling what else. You're thinking we're going to discover that she's into other databases. Jill Donahue picks up her drink, and I can smell the scotch's sherry finish as I walk past her and hand out small plates and napkins. Yes. Benton sits back down next to Janet, who is watching Lucy horse around with Desi, Jet Ranger, and our rescued greyhound, Sock. Lucy grabs a green rubber ball off the lawn and tosses it, and when she darts and dodges playfully, I catch a glimpse of the .40-caliber pistol in her ankle holster. Jet Ranger runs several steps, and that's enough exertion for him. He sits as Sock wanders off to his favorite rest stop of rose bushes, and Desi races to the ball laughing hilariously. He hurls it back to Lucy as the screen door bangs shut, and Marino emerges, drinking a bottle of Red Stripe beer. He wears a pistol in the waistband of his jeans. Janet and Benton also are armed, and I'm reminded that no one close to me is very far from a gun at any given time. We don't know where Carrie is. We have no clue. We can't trust that cases haven't been tampered with and turned into data fiction. Donahue is presenting the case as she sees it. That's the point, Janet says. Every single record or report she might have accessed will be questioned. Defense attorneys will have a field day. I know I would. Not would, but will, Benton says to her. People will get out of prison. Right and left, is his answer. Dirtbags who will want to send Benton and Kay a thank you note. Janet is sipping the sparkling wine, her eyes on Lucy and Desi. I would think that's a very real threat, Donahue says. You can't know who might come around, and these days it's easy to figure out where somebody lives. Classic Carrie payback, Janet says. And that's what this is about. It's about her need to overpower. It's about her need to be a god, Benton says. And one place we might go is California. We could move there and be safer than we are here. That's a given. But the prospect of uprooting is overwhelming, and I don't believe it will do any good. We can't escape Carrie. If she doesn't want us to find her, we won't, even if she's breathing down our necks. It seems impossible we could be inside the same house with her and not have any idea, but that's what happened. For the better part of the past 6 months, she was below ground in a tunnel that had been sealed off since the Civil War. Lucy suspects Carrie found out about it the same way other people have. It's in old documents. You just have to look. And the ultimate in taking power, Benton describes to Donahue, is to stalk, to steal someone's identity, and then finally take the person's life. Which is what she did to Chanel Gilbert. Donahue stares off thoughtfully, watching Lucy play tug of war with Sock. Leave it! Leave it! Lucy says, and he drops the green ball and looks bored. I smell the perfume of the roses along the back wall behind our Cambridge house, and the breeze is cool for August. The sun burns bright orange over rooftops and trees, and soon I need to go back inside and finish preparing dinner. But it's not just that. I don't want to sit here. It's hard for me to listen to the stories. I've heard them multiple times, and they don't get better in the retelling. Chanel Gilbert was a Navy underwater photographer who left the military to work for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. One of her aliases was Elsa Mulligan, the name Carrie called herself when she found the body and claimed to be the housekeeper. It's a bad story, the worst of stories, and it's all connected to cyber terrorism, to data fiction. The man murdered in a Boston hotel this summer, Joel Fagano, was also CIA. He and Chanel Gilbert were colleagues, both of them spies. Janet knew Chanel before Lucy did, and no one has told me what that means. We don't exactly know when Carrie alerted to Chanel. Benton continues to talk about what really can't be explained, not entirely. Probably it was when she began working as an advisor to the Ukrainian Security Service, Janet offers. Beyond that, who knows why anybody ends up on Carrie's radar? It's as subjective and personal as picking out who to date. Marino takes a big swallow of beer. It's sort of like being attracted to someone. That's what I've always figured. People are more the same than they're different. Benton remembers his drink, and ice rattles quietly. They fall in love with someone who looks like them. Chanel was fit and into extreme sports. She was compellingly attractive in an androgynous way. She would have appealed to Carrie's narcissism. So she takes on at least one of Chanel's identities, and even takes over her property here in Cambridge? Plus, she manages to get a Range Rover, an SUV the police, the FBI still can't find? You have to admit she's unbelievably brazen. Doesn't seem to have a fearful bone in her body. Donahue sounds annoyingly impressed. It enters my mind that she'd probably like nothing better than to represent a notorious monster like Carrie. The best place to hide is in plain view, Benton says. Neighbors saw a red Range Rover in and out. They caught glimpses of a young woman. Why would they think anything was amiss? Carrie's probably pulled stunts like this countless times all over the world. So she hijacked Chanel's life or lives, Donahue says. Then what made Carrie decide to kill her right after she returned here from Bermuda? It might simply have been a matter of practicality, Benton says. Chanel hadn't been here for a long time, so Carrie appropriated her property and then murdered her when she showed up. Something made her decide it, though. Lucy walks back to us and sits. And my theory is, when Carrie hung around after she shot you, she directs this at me, reaching for the bottle of Freesia d'Asti in the ice bucket. She watched Chanel help you to the surface, basically save your life, and that marked Chanel for death. The same way Carrie marked you, and I push that from my mind. I don't want to imagine Lucy's tattooed dragonfly. I don't want to envision Carrie slashing her with the same Swiss Army knife that she fashioned into a crude mobile some 17 years later. I'm not saying she wasn't going to annihilate Chanel eventually, Lucy adds. She would have, Benton says. But when she watched Chanel save Kay's life, it pushed her over the edge. As much as we can simplify what is anything but simple when you're dealing with an offender like this. 2 months and 1 week ago, when I almost died, I didn't know that other dive boats in the area belonged to Special Ops. In retrospect, I'm not at all surprised, because Benton knows how dangerous Carrie is. He wouldn't allow us to dive 100 feet down in dark, murky water without making sure we were safe. As it turned out, we weren't. Certainly, the 2 police divers weren't. The tactical divers were a day late and a dollar short, to quote Marino. But they helped save my life after I was shot. Specifically, Chanel Gilbert did. Why might that have prompted Carrie to kill her? Donahue is asking. I'm trying to understand the reason. You're probably not going to, I reply. Jealousy. Resentment. Benton sips his drink. Chanel was the hero. She stole Carrie's thunder. That's as close as we're probably going to get to what goaded Carrie into it. There's no fortune cookie formula. That's the hard part, Lucy says. We don't know the details and might never. For example, I'm not sure of the relationship between Carrie and Chanel. Did they have one? Donahue asks. That's what I'm getting at, Lucy says. They could have. One of the problems with people in the intelligence community is they never seem to know whose side they're on, Janet says, as I get up to see about dinner and I just can't listen anymore. It's a squirrely way to live, she adds. And I carry my drink toward the back door. Janet and Lucy ask if they can help, but I say no. I tell everybody I'll get dinner on the table and they're to relax and enjoy their cocktails and antipasto. I open the screen door and feel something cold poke against the back of my injured leg, and I stop to turn around and pet Sox's long velvety snout. I see. So you're not going to stay with our company, I say to him as I let him inside the house. Well, there's not much you can help me with, but I'm happy for the company. I continue to talk to my shy, brindle greyhound as I open a drawer inside one of the refrigerators and select various greens, both tart and sweet lettuces, and 2 of my cherished homegrown tomatoes. A rinse and a whirl in the salad spinner, I explain cheerfully to Sock, and a dash or 2 of coarse ground pepper and sea salt. And we save the vinegar for last so it doesn't wilt everything. I continue talking to a dog who doesn't answer or bark. And then I hear the back door bang again. I'm startled. And just as quickly, I remember I'm home and I'm not alone. I hear quick, quiet footsteps in the hall. I'm cubing tomatoes as Desi walks into the kitchen, and he wants to know why I'm crying. I blame it on the Vidalia onions I'm just now peeling, but Desi is a perceptive little boy. He stands in the middle of my kitchen with his hands on his hips, his mussed-up brown hair in his big blue eyes. Aunt Janet says I'm helping you set the table. He opens a drawer and begins gathering silverware. Do you want to eat on the sun porch, or are you afraid? The sun porch is enclosed in glass. What might I be afraid of? I scan a selection of vinegars and decide on a Bordeaux. We're not sitting on the sun porch.
The bad lady who hurt you, Desi says. She might see us through the windows if we eat on the sun porch. Is that why you're crying?
She could see us sitting in the yard, I remind him.
I know. You can't stay here anymore, can you?
He slides out a chair from the breakfast table and sits down.
But you'll take me with you.
Where are we going?
We have to stay together, Aunt Kay, he says.
And technically, I'd be his great-aunt Kay if I were a blood relative. You know where the dining room is. Out this door and to the left. I hand him plates and folded napkins. We'll be fancy and eat in there.
That's not why.
We'll turn on the chandelier and pretend we're royalty.
I don't want to pretend. You don't want us sitting near windows. That's why we're not eating on the sun porch, isn't it? I don't want that bad lady to hurt us.
No one is going to hurt us. I collect glasses from a cupboard and follow Desi out of the kitchen, and I think about the way we lie to children. I can't tell Desi the truth. I won't have him live in fear. We're not safe, but for him to know that solves nothing. It makes things only worse. Now I'm going to teach you a trick. I turn on the overhead alabaster chandelier inside the dining room. That's assuming you might want to learn a trick. I close the draperies and big windows overlooking the side yard.
Yes, please show me.
I get placemats out of the break front and help him set the table. I teach him how to fold linen napkins into a tree, a flower, a horse, a bow tie. By the time we make an elf hat, he's giggling. He's laughing hysterically. Then I fold a napkin into a heart. I put it on a plate. This is your place, I say to him. And you know what that means, don't you? I wrap my arms around him.
It means I sit here.
It means I've given you my heart.
Because you love me.
Yes. I kiss the top of his head. I think I might. Maybe just a little bit. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Depraved Heart, a Scarpetta novel by Patricia Cornwell. This program was produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2015 by Cornwell Entertainment Incorporated. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.